Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop. Today's program is Current Perspectives on the Treatment of Colorectal Cancer. And today's program is part one of a two-part series of Living with Colorectal Cancer, and so you'll hear more about the second part, but today we're going to focus really on the treatment of colorectal cancer. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration and because of your interest in this topic that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 650 participants, and you come from all over the United States. You come from all different parts of the United States, and we also have international participants from Australia, Brazil, Canada, China, Germany, India, and Ireland, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. It's a bit of a global call, actually, and it's terrific having all of you on the call today. Now, this program was made possible by Bayer Healthcare Pharmaceuticals, Genentech, a member of the Roche Group, Bristol-Myers Squibb, and Spectrum Pharmaceuticals, Inc. I really want to thank them for supporting the program and for their industry collaborative support in making this program possible. Now, you did receive information from Cancer Care. In that information, there is some request for you to complete an evaluation form, and I would ask you all to please complete that evaluation form at the end of today's program. You know, your feedback is very important to us as we move forward in planning other programs. And so if there's a topic you'd like us to offer or there's some comments you'd like to make, please let us know, because this is a great time to make recommendations. We're planning many programs for 2013, and so you're our best consultants in terms of what we should be offering. So do tell us what you would like us to offer. And now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Eunice Kwok. Dr. Kwok is instructor, Department of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. She's assistant in medicine, hematology, oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Kwok is going to address an overview of colorectal cancer, current standard of care, new treatment approaches, predicting response to treatment, or the role of personalized medicine, and KRAS gene and targeted cancer therapies. It's now my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Kwok.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon to everyone. I'm going to give a brief overview of colorectal cancer, and I'm going to start by saying that this is a common disease. There are 140,000 new cases each year in the United States. About 100,000 of these cases are colon cancers, and about 40,000 cases are rectal cancers. Colorectal cancer mortality has fortunately been progressively declining since 1990. However, it does still remain the second most common cause of cancer death in the U.S. So one way that we can work to try to decrease the incidence of colorectal cancer is by screening. And colonoscopy is really one of the favored ways of screening for possibility of colon cancer or for trying to find polyps that could prevent somebody from becoming a person to develop colon cancer. So the population can be thought of as those who are of average risk for developing colon cancer. Those would be people who have no symptoms or signs, such as no signs of bleeding, no bowel changes, no habit changes in their bowels, no pain. So in the setting of no symptoms or signs and no history of an adenomatous polyp, the adenomas are the types of polyps that can over time become colorectal cancers, or no history, personal history of colorectal cancer, also no history of an inflammatory bowel disease such as Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, and no family history. So this average risk population is recommended to start screening for colorectal cancer by age 50. There is, however, a portion of the population that can be considered to be at increased risk, and increased risk could be as simple as having a family member who has colorectal cancer. For instance, a first-degree relative with colorectal cancer or adenoma, that precancerous polyp, or if you have several first-degree relatives with any sort of colorectal cancer or adenoma history, these people are usually recommended to start colonoscopy screening by age 40 or 10 years younger than the onset of the colorectal cancer or adenoma in the family member that was affected. For people who have a personal history of a polyp or colorectal cancer or a history of inflammatory bowel disease, there would be a need for increased surveillance by colonoscopy, and that can be discussed with their physician. In addition, there are families for which there seems to be, as people look through their family tree, a lot of cancers. So a strong history of colorectal cancer or really any other kind of cancers, particularly if the cancers are early in onset. For instance, a colorectal cancer before the age of 50 in a family member, even if there isn't a strong family history, or if there is evidence of a colorectal cancer in multiple generations of a family tree, those are people that I usually refer for genetic counseling to try to establish what their family's risk is of developing colorectal cancer. In somebody for whom colon cancer has been diagnosed, the next step is to be fully staged. And staging usually involves, particularly in the setting of what we believe to be resectable disease at the outset, a colonoscopy, an abdomen and pelvis CT scan, perhaps a chest scan, and those would be diagnostic CT scans, not routinely PET CT scans, and then lab work including a carcinoembryonic antigen, or a CEA, which is a tumor marker that can be elevated in the setting of colon cancer, similarly to a prostate-specific antigen in prostate cancer. The staging system for colorectal cancer is a tumor node metastasis staging system. So when we think of staging, we think about how deep does the tumor invade into the wall of the colon or the rectum, and that is represented by the T stage, and the T stage is broken down into 1, 2, 3, 4. And then we think about the N stage or the nodal stage to see whether there are nodes involved or not involved. And then finally, as part of the staging system, we think about the M stage, which is whether there are any distant metastases or not. And so that T and M staging is pulled together into an overall stage of stage 1, 2, 3, or 4, at least broadly speaking. And that is oftentimes what people come to me asking about: what stage are they, or what does the T mean, or what does the N mean? So for the overall staging, the stage 1, 2, 3, and 4, stage 3 cancer is stage 1, 2, and 3 cancer. Those cancers are primarily treated with surgery. Certainly, those would be the settings in which the goal of surgery would be to cure the disease. The setting in which one would introduce chemotherapy usually would be in the setting of stage 3 disease, that is, disease that includes involvement of the lymph nodes after surgical resection. So a surgery has been done and the specimen is looked at under the microscope and there appears to be nodal involvement. That would involve adjuvant therapy. Standardly, for stage 3 cancer, again, node-positive cancer, we are recommending a combination of chemotherapies called FOLFOX, which includes fluorouracil, oxaliplatin, as well as leucovorin. In stage 3 cancer, in node-positive cancer, we'd like to see at least 12 lymph nodes included in the surgical specimen. If there are fewer than 12 lymph nodes and the reading is that there are no lymph nodes involved but the denominator is fewer than 12, then it's hard to rely upon that number and know that the specimen really does not contain involved lymph nodes. So again, the adjuvant therapy after surgery is usually FOLFOX, the 5-FU leucovorin with oxaliplatin, for 6 months. It could also be a relative of 5-FU called capecitabine in combination with oxaliplatin. Or in some cases, we can use capecitabine by itself or 5-FU and leucovorin by themselves. The goal of the adjuvant therapy is to help improve upon the chances of an overall survival. The real crux of being curable comes in the surgery, but chemotherapy is really trying to improve upon the chances of cure. Interestingly, recent evidence from some of the clinical trials that have been followed for a longer period of time have shown that in two populations, the addition of oxaliplatin to 5-FU does not seem to help as much as we once thought. So, for instance, in the population of patients who are older than age 70, the addition of oxaliplatin did not seem to help their outcomes significantly compared to just getting 5-FU alone. So FOLFOX is not better than 5-FU leucovorin alone. Similarly, there's another group of people that don't seem to necessarily benefit from the addition of FOLFOX or oxaliplatin to 5-FU, and those would be the patients whose disease is what we call high-risk stage 2. So stage 2 that is high-risk would be considered a specimen that has fewer than 12 lymph nodes assessed, so that you can't really rely upon whether there's nodal involvement or not. In addition, a poorly differentiated histology, unless the setting is in what we call microsatellite unstable or the microsatellite instability situation, which is a pathologic diagnosis. If there's any evidence of lymphatic or vascular invasion or perineural invasion, bowel obstruction, perforation, or close margins at the resection, those would be considered high-risk cases. And we used to treat those cases frequently with FOLFOX, but these days we're looking back at that population and thinking perhaps they don't actually benefit as much as we thought from the addition of oxaliplatin to the 5-FU, and maybe 5-FU with leucovorin by itself is adequate. In terms of completion of adjuvant therapy for resected disease, I usually follow my patients every 3 months with a CEA. The standard recommendation per the NCCN guidelines would be a history and physical with CEA. Every CEA is the blood test that is a tumor marker for colon cancer. So a CEA every 3 to 6 months for 2 years, then every 6 months until 5 years, and then an annual chest, abdomen, and pelvis CT scan to look radiographically as a surveillance for the possibility of recurrence. Patients are usually recommended to get a colonoscopy 1 year after their surgery or sooner if their original colonoscopy at the time of diagnosis was not able to be a complete colonoscopy. As far as disease that has spread beyond stage 3, that is stage 4 disease, where disease has spread beyond the place where it has started, or metastatic disease, chemotherapy, systemic therapy, is really the mainstay of treatment. In addition to chemotherapy, we have several biologic agents, some of which we use in the first-line setting, meaning the first time a newly diagnosed patient with metastatic disease receives chemotherapy, they may, in addition, receive a drug called bevacizumab, which is an antibody to the vascular endothelial growth factor protein, and that drug, bevacizumab, is thought to work by helping to impede blood vessel growth and function, and therefore works as an anti-angiogenic approach. The other biologic agent that is sometimes used in the first-line setting is an antibody to the epidermal growth factor receptor, either panitumumab or cetuximab, and it's thought that these antibodies can help interfere with the signals that drive cancer growth through this EGFR receptor. Now, interestingly, the use of panitumumab or cetuximab, these drugs that inhibit the epidermal growth factor receptor, or EGFR, they should only be used when a tumor, a colon tumor or a rectal tumor, has been tested genetically and found to not harbor a KRAS mutation. So that's a situation that we call KRAS wild type. If the normal version of the KRAS gene, and a KRAS gene is a gene that's thought to be very important in cancer, If that gene is normal in a patient's tumor, then that patient could be a candidate for cetuximab or panitumumab. But if that KRAS mutation is, if that KRAS gene harbors a mutation or an abnormality, then those patients don't appear to benefit from panitumumab or cetuximab therapy, and would not be offered that therapy, in fact. KRAS mutations are found in about 40% of colorectal cancers. So again, in the first line setting, chemotherapy, which could be FOLFOX, the same treatment that was discussed in the adjuvant setting, 5-FU-leucovorin and oxaliplatin, which could be combined with bevacizumab, the anti-angiogenic drug, or cetuximab or panitumumab if the KRAS wild type status is known. Sometimes the first line therapy can be FOLFIRI, which is 5-FU and leucovorin in combination with irinotecan, and again, the biologics bevacizumab or cetuximab can be included. The second line therapy can then switch to whatever chemotherapy was not used previously. For instance, if someone started out with FOLFOX, they might move to FOLFIRI. If they started out with FOLFIRI, they might move to FOLFOX. One of the newer findings recently is that in the second line, a new drug called aflibercept, which is another anti-angiogenic strategy, sort of the same idea as bevacizumab, has been found to be effective in the second line in combination with FOLFIRI. And another new drug that has come about and has been used on the basis of phase 3 data showing a modest improvement in overall survival is a drug called regorafenib. Regorafenib is a pill form of chemotherapy, or really targeted therapy, I should say. It inhibits proteins that are at cell surfaces that are involved in signaling, and regorafenib would be a reasonable drug to consider in the third line setting if one is not considering clinical trials. One word about another mutation that is found in tumors is the BRAF mutation, which can be found in approximately 10% of colorectal, I'm sorry, 8% of colorectal cancers. This mutation, similar to the KRAS mutation, can cause inappropriate signals that cause cancers to grow and not die. And there are increasing numbers of clinical trials directed towards this BRAF mutation tumor population because new drugs have been developed recently that are very good at inhibiting these kinds of signals. Finally, in the metastatic setting for colon cancer, sometimes surgery can be introduced. Previously, we thought that metastatic disease or disease that had spread to other places, for instance, the liver or the lung, was not curable. But these days we're being very aggressive about sending people for resection or surgical removal of their metastatic sites of disease. And a subgroup of these patients can indeed be cured. Finally, just to talk a bit about rectal cancer, the difference between rectal cancer and colon cancer is that rectal cancer is really distinguished by its location in the body. So because of the way that the bowel in the rectum cones down into the pelvis, and because of the tight confines of the pelvis, treatment is really focused on trying to prevent local recurrences that can be very debilitating in terms of pain and other symptoms, in addition to trying to prevent distant recurrences. Therefore, unlike colon cancer, radiation is part of rectal cancer treatment. Particularly if the tumor appears to be of a stage T3 or higher or a node-positive disease. We usually start with a combination of chemotherapy and radiation, followed by surgery, then followed by additional adjuvant chemotherapy. And I think I'll stop my comments right there.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Kwok, for this wonderful, really, overview of colorectal cancer, really covering, making it very understandable for our audience and making the complex so much more understandable for everybody. So thank you. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Edith Mitchell. And Dr. Mitchell is clinical professor of medicine and medical oncology, program leader, gastrointestinal oncology, Department of Medical Oncology. She's Associate Director of Diversity Programs, and she's Director, Center for Elimination of Cancer Disparities, Kimmel Cancer Center at Jefferson. And Dr. Mitchell is going to address the role of clinical trials, how research contributes to your treatment options, practical tips to manage side effects and pain, communicating with your healthcare team, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Mitchell.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It is a pleasure to be with the team and the group today. I'm delighted to be on the program with other well-renowned and such an experienced and honorable team. So I will address these topics very broadly, but for all patients with colon and rectal cancer, what I want you to take away today is that patients are living longer. There is improved survival in patients with colon and rectal cancer, and it's not just the medications. It is really the entire treatment plan. And what do I mean by that? Well, first of all, clinical trials are really very important. And they are very important to help develop new drugs, new medications, and new regimen for treating cancer so that we can continue to say that there is continued improvement in survival. Clinical trials may be conducted to develop new drugs, to develop new plans, or to just understand the disease process, who is at risk of the disease, how can we prevent it, and what are the methods for finding individuals who may be at high risk. It is very important for patients to understand clinical trials and to understand that the way we can improve survival and continue to improve survival is through clinical trials. So what are some of the clinical trials? You've heard from Dr. Kwok about the new drugs that have been approved for treating colon and rectal cancer. All of those drugs were approved based on a clinical trial. And whether a drug is one that requires a prescription or one that is over-the-counter. Over-the-counter medications also are evaluated by clinical trials. So clinical trials help us evaluate both disease processes as well as medications to treat diseases and ways of diagnosis and prevention of the disease. So clinical trials are very important. And patients can ask about participating in clinical trials. And your physicians or your healthcare team may also ask you about a clinical trial. And one way of finding out about clinical trials is to go onto the website clinicaltrials.gov. Many clinical trials will be on the internet, but some of those clinical trials are on sites that are not safe for patients. But a good one to remember is clinicaltrials.gov. Through these clinical trials and other research procedures, we are developing new treatment plans, treatment regimen, and therefore we can continue to say that our patients are living longer. One of the important aspects of research and clinical trials is to treat other conditions that may be present and require simultaneous treatment. Some of those problems may occur even prior to the diagnosis of cancer. Some can occur later, and some may develop as a result of the treatment. So it's very important for the patient to make sure that their healthcare team knows all that they need to know about any other medical problems, about medications that the patient might be taking, whether those medications are prescribed by a doctor or other healthcare professional, or whether they are received and are over-the-counter medications or whether they are obtained through other sources. Many people are taking herbal products. It's very important to let your healthcare team know about those products and make sure that they're incorporated into your plan. I always advise my patients to have a written list of all medications, whether they are over-the-counter or herbal or whatever, in as well as any other medical providers that they may see for other medical conditions, so we'll know everything. So what are some of these side effects and other medical conditions that may be included in the overall plan for colon and rectal cancer? One of the most common is anemia. Many patients present with anemia prior to the diagnosis of colon cancer and thereby require some treatment. Everybody is always concerned about nausea, vomiting. There are so many medications available to totally prevent nausea and vomiting with chemotherapy, so therefore patients don't have to assume that they're going to have nausea and vomiting. Another is fatigue, and fatigue may occur with a number of different conditions and a number of causes, so let your healthcare team know about it. Diarrhea can be prominent, but there are medications to control diarrhea. Nutrition is very important, for many patients will have lost weight prior to diagnosis and may continue to lose weight afterwards, so it's very important to talk to the person on the nutrition team to maintain body weight, to eat well, and to eat foods that are very important for continued health maintenance. Mucositis or irritation of the mouth is very important, so it's always very important to check with your dentist, continue to make sure that you're following good mouth or oral habits, cleaning the teeth, flossing, and taking care of the gums. Neuropathy can occur after colon cancer treatment. And again, there are some medications such as oxaliplatin where almost 100% of the patients develop some type of neuropathy. For most patients, it goes away once the treatment has completed. However, some may have long-standing problems, so it's very important to talk with your team about it. One of the other areas that's not talked about much is depression. And sometimes I call this situational reaction because it's not that the patient has primary depression. The fact is they have a challenging situation and may therefore need some assistance with this. So whatever the team, whatever the symptoms and whatever the changes in symptoms, it's very important to talk with your doctor or other member of the healthcare team. Let them know that there have been changes such that the overall plan for patients is to have a good quality of life, to not let the cancer determine one's quality of life, but let you control the cancer, because patients are living longer with cancer now, and especially with colon cancer, so it's a chronic disease and therefore should be treated as such. There may be long-term and ongoing factors, but always talk to your doctor, talk to the team about it. The idea is to have good quality of life, to have the best treatment available, to receive that treatment on a regular and ongoing basis as needed, but also to feel good, to look good. Always utilize other resources such as makeup or hair, whatever kinds of things you have utilized before. These can help sustain you through cancer treatment and thereby afterwards. Then once cancer treatment is finished, there will be continuous and ongoing follow-up, but again, always let your doctors know if there is a change in how you feel, if there's a change in pain, if there is a development of any other side effect. Make sure your doctors know about it, and thereby they can advise you on controlling it or tell you whether it is important or not. So always communicate well with your healthcare team, have a good quality of life, get the best treatment available, and go on with your life. Whatever makes you happy, continue to do it. You can travel. You can continue in sports. You can continue to do most of the activities that you participated in prior to development of cancer. So always have a good quality of life as your focus. With that, I'd like to stop, and I'll be happy to answer any questions later.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Mitchell, for just a really wonderful presentation and really for helping to go over all of the issues that people really feel challenging during their treatment of colorectal cancer. So thank you so much, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Diana Bearden. Diana is a dietitian, a registered dietitian. She's the supervisor of clinical nutrition at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Bearden is going to address nutritional concerns and tips. Ms. Bearden?
Thank you, Carolyn. Good afternoon, everyone. So to start with, during treatment, the nutritional goal is to eat the best that you can within the constraints of any side effects that you may be experiencing. And one of the roles of the dietitian is to help patients make these selections and help guide them through their treatment. So some general suggestions for accomplishing maintaining optimal nutrition during your treatment is including small frequent meals throughout the day, maybe even 5 to 6 different times. And when you are eating, choosing nutrient-dense foods and talking with your dietitian or the nutrition team in more specifics on what might be appropriate for you is what I would recommend. Planning meals and snacks ahead of time, especially when you're going through treatment, fatigue can be an issue, and like you may have heard during the talk today, stress can be another factor that patients are dealing with, and planning meals may just be another stress on top of that. So if you can do it ahead of time or ask for support from friends and family, that can help alleviate some of the need for you to address these concerns. Drinking plenty of fluids, consuming adequate protein, which is very important, especially if you've undergone surgery or if you're in active treatment at the time, consuming enough protein is very important. And remain active as best as you can and what's appropriate as directed by your physician. Being active and doing physical activities will not only help with digestion, but it can also help stimulate appetite at times. So some common side effects that patients experience are nausea and vomiting, a decreased appetite, taste changes, mouth sores, and diarrhea. So just to address these common side effects and some ways that are commonly used to manage them, I want to go ahead and review with you all today. So if you're experiencing nausea and vomiting, like we talked about earlier in the presentation, medications can be very helpful with managing these side effects. But as far as trying to get different foods into your diet that will be tolerated, suggestions that we provide are things like eliminating offending odors. A lot of times foods that are warm have an odor that can become offensive or even trigger some of these symptoms. Keeping something on your stomach, bland foods a lot of times like dry crackers or toast can be very helpful. And they don't have odors associated with them, so that's another benefit. Avoiding foods that are overly sweet, greasy, fried, or highly seasoned. Eating foods at room temperature, they don't have to be cold necessarily, but whatever we can do to reduce the odors with food is very helpful for patients, we find. Again, keeping good oral care is an important part of this as well, primarily because taste changes can be something patients experience, and we just want to make sure that the oral care is there to assist with keeping any infection or any issues down with your oral care. Eliminating stress at the meal times. Increased stress can result in indigestion, which would result then in decreased intake. And like I said earlier, you know, some patients may benefit from medication. So speaking with your healthcare team about these side effects that you may experience and following what the doctors say, on taking the medication, a lot of times you might feel better, but it may be because the medication's working. So talk with your healthcare team before discontinuing any medication that they've prescribed for you. Another common side effect that patients experience are taste changes. And like I've mentioned earlier, keeping good oral care is important. And to do this, you know, you definitely want to have checkups with your dentist, and rinsing your mouth, brushing, flossing, those sorts of things are very important. But a lot of times when you're experiencing taste changes, it can be a side effect of the medications and some of the treatments. And what we find is just rinsing your mouth with some baking soda mixed in water can just swish and spit can be very helpful, just kind of cleansing your palate. If you're having a metallic taste, you're experiencing that, switching your utensils to plastic or glass is very helpful. And to enhance taste, a lot of times patients experience some taste more strongly than others. And so to enhance a dull taste or things that don't feel like they have any or don't seem to have any taste any longer, maybe adding some tart flavors to that can be helpful, such as pickles, lemons, vinegar. And trying foods that you previously didn't like, you may actually like now. It's unusual, I know, to think that that could be the case, but we've had patients who that's been very helpful. Mouth sores is another side effect that can happen through treatment, and this can be very painful for patients. And so from a nutrition standpoint, definitely choosing soft, moist foods that are easy to swallow that don't require a lot of manipulation. Avoiding anything rough or textured, acidic or tart, spicy foods that may irritate your mouth. Cut foods into small bites or even potentially puree or mash your foods, then again, just to reduce the amount of chewing that's required. And at times, using supplement drinks may be warranted, so talking with your healthcare team about that. And then again, practicing good oral care and talking with your doctor. There are medications they can give to help alleviate the discomfort of mouth sores. So following the directions on the medications prescribed by your physician is very important. Diarrhea can be another side effect patients experience. And depending on the source of the diarrhea or the reason for the diarrhea, management will be very independent. And so what I would say is if you're experiencing diarrhea, talk with your healthcare team because it can be caused for a lot of different reasons. But some things that might be helpful to avoid if you are having diarrhea is a lot of times adjusting the fiber in your diet, avoiding foods that are high in sugar alcohols that can cause more diarrhea in patients, and paying attention to how much concentrated sweets you're having in the diet as well, because that can also result in diarrhea in some patients. If you are having diarrhea, it's important for you to be aware of your hydration status. And if you are experiencing symptoms of dehydration, or if you first sign if you're having a lot of diarrhea, let your team know. Be able to convey to them how much fluid you've been taking, how frequently you've been experiencing the diarrhea, because there may be some electrolytes that need to be addressed, and it's easier to address those issues early on rather than after you've been experiencing dehydration for a prolonged period of time. So I hope this has been helpful, and this concludes my contribution that I've planned for today. I'm willing and happy to answer any additional questions you all have. I'm going to hand it back over to Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Diana. That was a wonderful presentation, and you really really have so many tips for people and helpful suggestions, and this is such an important area for our people on the call, so thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Sarah Kelly, and Sarah is an oncology social worker, and Sarah is with Cancer Care, and she is going to address the free psychosocial services offered by Cancer Care, as well as describe our colorectal cancer support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Sarah.
Thank you, Carolyn, and I also want to thank the rest of the presenters. It's a lot of wonderful information
that we're getting today. So as Carolyn said, I am an oncology social worker here, and I work with many people with colorectal cancer as well as their caregivers. And what I really want to talk about is the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how cancer care can be a part of that. So Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization. We provide free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our programs include individual counseling, that's face-to-face in the New York City area, and also over the phone nationally. Support groups, which we also provide face-to-face in the New York area, over the phone nationally, and also online. We have education about resources, of course, these workshops. We provide information on how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help that you may need, and also just limited financial assistance, including chemotherapy copay assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's-level oncology social workers, and they're completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They're also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease. You know, some of the things I've already mentioned, so financial concerns. You know, the rest of the presenters talked a lot about physical changes, social adjustment, psychological impact, and all-around care. And adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is also an important part of the healing process. You know, as many of you know, cancer does not affect just the person who's diagnosed. It infects the entire support network. Asking for help, and I really can't stress this enough, by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. And that's something I'd really like for you to take away from this today. You know, joining a support group, you can connect with others who are going through a similar situation or experiencing similar problems. And in individual counseling, you really do have a space that's just yours to voice concerns that you may have. And the connections, these types of connections help lessen the isolation that often comes along with a cancer experience. If you're feeling well emotionally, this can help you better cope with the diagnosis and treatment. And, you know, I know that Dr. Mitchell talked about depression and quality of life. These are such an important part of the process and the healing process. Right now, I do want to talk about what we're providing in terms of colorectal cancer. So right now we have a group that is over the phone. That's a support group for anyone diagnosed with colorectal cancer. We also have online groups right now for those who are diagnosed with colorectal cancer. In addition, for your loved ones, for the caregivers, we have a face-to-face group in the New York area, as well as online groups. We also have a young adult caregivers group. That's anyone who's between the ages of 18 and 40. So that's kind of a unique group that we have. If you're interested in any of our services, please call our Hope Line. The number is 1-800-813-4673. And if you haven't, I also just suggest that you check our website, and that's www.cancercare.org. We have a comprehensive website, all of our publications there. There's a lot of really good information about the cancer diagnosis and treatment and just how to get support with us. And, you know, as we've talked about in today's program, there's a lot of information, right? You get a lot of information from a lot of different sources, and it's a lot to digest. One of the things we can do here at Cancer Care is help you digest it, help you understand what it means for you and your family and your loved ones. You know, if you have a social worker here, we can help you prioritize. And if you need to, we can also help you, you know, go through and talk about questions that you might have for your medical team. I just, at the end, really want you to know that you're not alone in this, even though it can sometimes feel very isolating. Our services are here to help you. I just want to thank everyone for listening today and for the opportunity to talk. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much, Sarah, for just a very just wonderful presentation about the service of cancer care, just the enthusiastic, number of services that we have, and that we really do encourage people to take advantage of these free services to help with coping, and so important. And now we do have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to have Stephanie explain to you how to queue up for questions, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get to your question or you think of a question after, of course, the call has ended, you can simply call 1-800-813-HOPE, and our social workers will be here to help you. But right now, let's see how many of your questions we can take. So, Stephanie, could you explain to everybody how to queue up for questions?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, if you have a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone.
We have a question for one of our online participants, and the question actually has to do with the how do you distinguish between cancer that is hereditary, perhaps a colorectal cancer that might be hereditary, versus one that is has had some genetic testing, and that often is quite confusing. So I'm wondering if Dr. Quack, if you could address that. It frequently comes up. People are kind of confused about the two because the word gene is in both of them.
Right. So really the key is family history. So in any family, if there is even one individual who's diagnosed with the colorectal cancer, first-degree relatives of that individual have an increased risk of also developing colon cancer. It's certainly not a situation where those family members are definitely going to get it, but they're going to be at somewhat higher risk than the population that does not have affected family members. So that's why if somebody is diagnosed with colon cancer in a family, we often recommend, or we always recommend, that the siblings or other first-degree relatives have screening colonoscopies, particularly if they have not already. In terms of trying to distinguish whether there's an identifiable genetic component, so certainly, again, having a family member who's affected can mean that there is some hereditary risk, but that risk may not exactly be quantifiable or even identifiable in terms of a specific gene. There are a few specific genes that are responsible for the identified hereditary predisposition syndromes, such as Lynch syndrome or familial adenomatous polyposis, or a handful of other predisposition syndromes where there is a defect in specific genes that can be identified within a person affected by a colon cancer or within their family members, even if those family members have not been affected, simply by doing a blood test. So being on sort of the trail of that kind of situation involves taking a very careful look at family history and the age of onset of the cancers, because the age of onset tends to be an earlier age than for a sporadic colorectal cancer. Sporadic meaning that it happens in the cancer happens without any clear family history pattern. And so in terms of gene testing, I've talked about there are certain genes that predispose families, because those gene defects run in some members of a family predisposed to colon cancer or other types of cancer. But that's to be distinguished from, for instance, the KRAS gene testing that I was talking about, where in that situation we are really only testing an individual's tumor itself, and the KRAS gene mutation or the KRAS gene testing is really only applicable to the tumor in that one individual, whereas in a hereditary predisposition syndrome, you can check the blood of various family members and figure out whether a gene may or may not be altered. Again, that's the hereditary situation or the germline situation versus the sporadic or somatic situation, which is where we talk about KRAS. I don't know if that clarifies things, but that's probably a start.
Well, thank you very much. That's very helpful. Thank you. And Stephanie, our next question?
Our next question comes from Richard R. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to clarify. You were talking about Fulfiri and the is that an effective second-line therapy for KRAS-mutated patients?
Right, so FOLFIRI certainly can be used in the second line, for instance, after FOLFOX. Using FOLFIRI, this chemotherapy combination of 5-FU, leucovorin, and irinotecan, can be used regardless of KRAS mutation status. It's when you start adding in the biologics such as cetuximab or panitumumab where you want to know what the tumor mutation status is with respect to KRAS.
Excellent. Thank you. And a question for Dr. Mitchell. In terms of clinical trials, then how does someone know what the right trial is for them? One of our online participants has that question.
I think the first thing one should consider when evaluating clinical trials is to talk with your doctor and healthcare team. They can recommend clinical trials. Many may have clinical trials available at their own institution. And then if one wants general information, there is a website called clinicaltrials.gov where all of the available trials that are really important in the country are on that website. What you shouldn't do is just Google or through some other technique find a clinical trial because some of those trials, one, may not be appropriate, may not be valid trials. So I do recommend two ways. Talk with your doctor or other members of the team, or if you want to search, then clinicaltrials.gov.
Excellent. Thank you. And one question from John, actually one of our online participants. Are there foods to avoid or methods to cook foods to be avoided? And then the other another question as a follow-up is about what about sugar and diet? So we talked about that earlier, and here it is, so someone asking about that.
Okay, yeah, and I'll be happy to answer that. This is Diana, the dietitian. Yeah, there's no evidence-based research to show that cancer is fed by sugar. So eating a variety of foods in your diet is actually what we want to aim for. Like I said, there may be symptoms or side effects a patient may experience to where changes in food selections may be warranted, and that's why talking with your healthcare team about any side effects you may be experiencing is so important, and they can help provide suggestions and ways to modify your foods at times. You know, it may be necessary to cut back on fiber, or it may be important to increase fiber, or it may be important to avoid foods that for some reason you're just not tolerating. But in general, we want to have you eating a relatively plant-based diet is a good diet to aim for with foods, some raw, some cooked. We want you having a variety of foods in your diet and a variety of cooking methods. But for the most part, deep frying, foods with a lot of sauces, things that tend to be higher in saturated fats, we want you to avoid just as an overall healthy diet and focus more on your baking, broiling, for methods of cooking your lean proteins, et cetera. But speaking with your dietitian would be very helpful to come up with a plan to individualize it for your needs.
And Dr. Mitchell, do you want to comment about this, the issue about the sugar? Because people do often ask that. They seem to think that there's a question about sugar and that sugar is not good for cancer. Can you say something about that as well?
Certainly. Many patients think and receive information regarding what they should eat, and I can tell you there are innumerous trials and methods and diets out there for the cancer patient. And many patients believe that they should not consume sugar because sugar feeds the cancer. And I tell my patients, yes, sugar feeds the cancer, but it also feeds your kidneys and your heart and your brain. Your body cannot function without some sugar. The main thing is to make sure that the patient eats foods that taste good and that they like. Also to try and maintain body weight. It's very clear that patients tolerate treatment and actually live longer if they are able to maintain their body weight. So it's eating a good, healthy diet, very good quality foods, and eating on a regular basis so that one can maintain their diet. And no, sugar is not harmful to the cancer patient, unless, of course, it is consumed in excess.
Excellent. Thank you. And a question actually for Sarah, it came in from one of our online participants about just needing help with just practical assistance and transportation for treatment and those kinds of things. Could you comment a bit about that in terms of just, because that's often a struggle for people getting to the treatments and people in different parts of the country who have far distances to travel. Could you comment on that?
Absolutely. You know, I think that the practical concerns are such an important part of this, and sometimes they really don't get talked about, but transportation is a big one, because in terms of getting your treatment, we know you've got to get to the treatment center. I will let you know, Cancer Care does provide some financial grants for help with transportation. If that is something that you feel like you're needing help with, please, please call us, and we will do our best to assist you with what we have and also maybe help you think of some other ways to get there.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. This has been an extraordinary call. I think the expertise and the energy and just the compassion of everybody on the call has been extraordinary. This has been an amazing team. We're going to have to bring everybody again together for our other programs that we do throughout the year. Also, I want to thank all of you who've, you know, posed questions to us, both online and on the telephone. It really enhances the call enormously. And I want to remind you that this is a one-hour program. And when the program is about to end, I just want to remind you that we do have lots of services that you can access from Cancer Care. I think Sarah did a wonderful job in explaining them to you. Most importantly, I don't want anyone to feel you're alone when this call ends. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support here at Cancer Care, and you can call us at any time at 1-800-813-HOPE. So no matter what the question or concern you might have, give us a call. Also, there is a part two to this series, actually on April 17th, Management of Metastatic Colorectal Cancer, which again is one that I know many of you have signed up for that, but please do, if you haven't, be aware of that. And we have a number of other programs that are also you have access to both on our website, and many of you got a calendar of upcoming programs as well. So I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all, and have a great day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.